Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron. I'm still discussing with Bruno how we're going to start, but since we're... Bruno, well, by the way, welcome to the show.
Morena.
Morena. So I just showed Bruno, and he's also just received an email about a news item that they've found something called freshwater gold clam across a 45-kilometre stretch of the Waikato River from all through Lake Karapiro through to Hamilton. And this doesn't sound good, Bruno. This is kind of your area, isn't it, a little bit scientifically?
Well, yeah, I guess...
It wasn't how we were going to start the show, but we've been talking about it right now, so I thought we might as well our heads in it, just talk about it.
Yeah, well, I suppose New Zealand's always been subject to multiple invasions over time, and, you know, I guess our unique isolation has meant that our animals here have also developed in a unique way. And so when something external comes in, it can quite often do quite well in the context of reproducing and becoming a problem. And this clam seems to be, at the early stages, reproducing pretty well. And we do have native clams as well. And so often, you know, there's a competition for space and all these sorts of other things. But this particular clam, it looks like, has been quite a successful invader in other countries overseas as well.
Yep.
Mainly through, you know, humans being the vector for that, as most invasives to this country have been in the past as
yes.
well.
So how? But so first of all, a picture. They are kind of goldy greeny colour, and about a centimetre wide, maybe a little bit bigger than a centimetre at a centimetre and a half. So they're not very big.
No.
But that doesn't mean that that's. Doesn't make it any better, does it, that they're little?
No, one of the interesting things I was just reading about here is that it's self-fertilizing. It's a simultaneous hermaphrodite, which basically it can reproduce asexually. So you only really need one of them in theory.
So it's an entire ecosystem inside a shell, basically.
<It's okay. laughs> Yeah, it's not a bad assessment.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, then it looks like that it internally, it'll produce brood, like young, which are like little planktonic larvae that will then disperse
and
then settle.
They're tiny.
Yeah. So immediately, as I'm thinking about this on the fly as well, we have endemic freshwater mussels, and they, in fact, behave similarly in the sense that they have a little larvae called a glochidia.
Yeah.
And that larvae, it's an interesting stage because it drifts down, but it attaches to the gills of our native freshwater fish, and those fish then move it around, transport it around.
Oh,
so
okay.
They can transport it in an upstream direction, whereas, you know, clams, when they sort of live, you know, and freshwater mussels, when they live down in the bed of the river, they have like a little foot, if you like, and they can slowly kind of make their way upstream, but it's not like they can swim upstream.
So, yes, or jump...
over waterfalls and things.
Yeah, dams as well. It was the dams I was thinking of. There's a few of those on the river. Yeah, okay. So, this has just come up now. We thought we'd mention it. How did it get here? This is my question, if the nearest place is Asia.
Yeah, so...
That it exists.
Yeah, again, a lot of these things, even like a lot of the pond weeds and things that you see in the Waikato River... hornwort, egeria, these sorts of invasive aquatic plants. So again, we have lots of native aquatic plants, but those invasive aquatic plants, many of them have actually arisen through the aquarium trade. And
right.
so they come in, people have some goldfish in a tank or something. They don't really know that much about what those plants are. You know, maybe they get sick of having those goldfish and don't want to kill it, so they'll tip it into the river. You quite often see this.
That's the kind of thing to do.
Yeah, and you know, you see this with the red-eared slider turtles. There's all sorts of animals like this that have been released to the wild, you know, probably with the good intention that someone didn't want to kill it, but then those animals being introduced or invasive, when the conditions are right, like in the case of the red-eared sliders, very interestingly, in the last few years, the climate has warmed to such a degree that they're able to now reproduce in New Zealand, whereas before it wasn't really possible with the temperatures that were being reached. But in their native home range, they're generally in warmer climates, and it's about the temperature that the sand is at for the eggs to develop, and you get males and females depending on the temperature at which the eggs incubate. So interestingly enough, over in Cook's Beach, I think it was 2-3 years ago, they found successfully hatching red-eared slider turtles. What danger do they pose? They don't have any predators here. They've got a hard shell. So all of these things that come in, you don't really know how it's going to go. But pretty much every response, and that's why MPI are onto this, or biosecurity, is that if you don't get the control or the elimination in that very, very early incursion phase, then you're either spending a hell of a lot of money just trying to keep control over it. You know, carp is a classic example.
But this is along 45, it's tiny and it's along 45 kilometre stretch of the river.
Yeah.
That's not early, is it, anymore?
That's hard yards.
To me, it doesn't feel like that's early anymore.
No, and I don't know, you know, and of course you're in a flowing environment with something that can reproduce and generate larvae, so how far down have those larvae already drifted and then settled?
And presumably the larvae is how they got here, maybe inside it, maybe in a fish?
Don't know. Yeah, at this stage, I don't know. They won't ever know,
but no. You're saying the aquarium trade might be the likely vector.
It could be.
As opposed to somebody bringing a boat, like a fishing boat from overseas to here with a bit of water still in it.
Less likely,
yeah,
I would say, but They'll be doing that. So one of the things that I understand that they're going to try and do is use environmental DNA. So this is where you take a sample of the water, and one of the things you can do, for example, is when the clam is in its reproductive phase, and again, I don't know enough about this animal at the moment, but if this animal has a certain period of the year that it throws all its larvae out, it'll be generating a lot of DNA, right? Yeah. And as that DNA floats downstream, you can take a water sample and you can detect the presence of this particular animal because you can sequence its DNA,
yeah,
and you can use that fairly rapidly to look at the extent of where it's gotten to, as long as you take enough samples. So
yeah,
I'd imagine they'll be out there doing that probably right, today.
Yes. Yeah, out there right now. Yeah. So is that freshwater ecologist? Is that how you describe?
That's how it was.
You used to work at regional council till you got...
I resigned.
Fed up.
I got, yeah, pretty much, yeah. I got fed up. And in fact, it was really about doing the sorts of things we're talking about where I have control or more control over the things that I sort of, you know, think are right and just and how I should try and do things. So not that I think that's going to change the world at all, but I kind of feel better about having control over, you know, some of the ways that I think things should be done and maybe challenging some of those principles.
The thing that changes the world is that there are people like you all around the world in little obscure places. We don't even know who they are, all doing this sort of thing, the journey you're on. And some people will discover your journey and they'll want that as well in their lives. And that's kind of how the world changes.
Yeah.
It doesn't change from what can change from one big powerful person making something happen. But
yeah,
this is a much more unstoppable way, I think.
Yeah. And I think back to the freshwater ecology side of things, you know, if you do pay a lot of attention and observation to nature, it's an awesome teacher. You know, it teaches you so many things. But when you learn how complex it really is and how little we know about it and how little we understand about it, but how badly we treat it, that's where it becomes very, very difficult for me to watch that slow train wreck happen. But a couple of the critters that, you know, that hopefully we'll talk about in a second, are just absolutely fascinating critters that we really should be paying a lot more respect to in terms of how we treat water, you know. Right from, you know, the emerging contaminants that are on a beer label that goes onto a beer bottle that might end up in a water course. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
These are the connections between industry and our environment that are really quite critical that we understand those things much better and have much more respect for it.
So have you seen that the government's got its freshwater policy statement thingamajig out? I was talking about this with someone about a month ago on the air. Are you completely not your head somewhere else these days?
Oh, look, I mean...
The reason I mention it is because the people at regional council say that basically they think the government copied their Plan 1 stuff work.
Yeah.
And it's moving slowly, but it's moving, I guess, so...
I've just seen these things happen time and time again, and what sort of happens now is that we've kind of allowed our environmental debt to kind of accrue, if you like, across the board. And water quality is one of those things where that debt is continuing to accrue in the negative direction. And that the policy that you require to change that is such a step change in terms of requirement, because you're actually dealing with a generational problem now. You're not dealing with a four-yearly election cycle problem. You're dealing with it. You're dealing with a generational problem, and no government will want to put in the policy required to actually deal with that accrual. It's like the $30 trillion US debt, right? Like that just that thing just keeps climbing up. And what you would actually need to do to address that, much the same way as some of our environmental debt, is to be incredibly bold with some of your policies. And no sane government will do it, because they'll get kicked out, because it affects too many people. And I kind of get that, but you've let that horse go too far. So how do you rein it back in a meaningful way that is going to see some change? It's not going to happen within any generation, yeah. And no one wants to see that.
There'll come a moment when it makes sense to enough people that, combined with a bold government, something can be done. I don't think it's today, but I think we're getting closer to it. But let's get away from politics. Yes. Let's talk about the things that inspired you. Were you intrigued when you started out, when you went to study science? Was it because you knew about these wacky, weird, wonderful things in the water, or?
I
put the heater.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Yeah, I grew up playing around in little streams. You know, I used to go fishing with my dad, and so I was always sort of, you know, intrigued by little critters. I thought I was going to be a herpetologist actually when I was younger,
which means
a studier of reptiles. I used to live in Australia, and I was surrounded by snakes, and I was actually really fascinated by lizards, and you know, some that have that bear live young, other ones that, you know, have eggs, and whatever, but fresh water is kind of where my sort of heart ended up taking me in my university studies and everything else. And when I moved to New Zealand, which I think was 22 or something years ago, one of the most fascinating critters that I came across was the New Zealand longfin eel. That's a really useful time to talk about that animal, because they're quite common in all of the streams around Raglan here.
Yeah.
But they are currently, you know, declining as a species in the country. And their life cycle is incredibly unique in that they live for a very, very long period of time, but they only reproduce once in their entire life. Oh, so
it's very inefficient.
It is very inefficient. And as a lot of funny animals in New Zealand have done, you know, like... you know, even the kakapo, like the reproductive rate of those things is just so low.
That's the story, isn't it? Every species that's on the endangered list is because it just doesn't breed enough. I mean,
they never had to breed.
Yeah, because New Zealand was so isolated, this country was so isolated that, yeah, these unusual things develop. So, yeah, back over to you.
Sorry, so back to the eel. So the reason this time of year is useful to talk about the longfin eel and give it, you know, a moment of thought is that this is around the time of year that they head off to reproduce and spawn. And so they do that out in the ocean over near the Tongan Trench. And the females...
They go from here to the Tongan Trench.
They go to the Tongan Trench on this incredibly long journey, and they don't... Once they they live in fresh waters their entire life until they go and do this migration to do the reproduction. And when they're in fresh water and they're about to do this migration, they physically start to change. So in the lead up to that migration, they build up a lot of fat reserves all over their body. And if you've ever seen a big female longfin eel, all of the really big ones are females, and that's an ecological part of their evolution to be able to carry lots and lots of eggs. Males can carry ridiculous amounts of sperm in a small kind of amount.
Fantastic.
But the eggs need to kind of, you know, to produce lots of eggs, you kind of need to be a big kind of female. So they stack all this fat on, and that stacking of fat on is going to be their energy reserve to do this massive migration, because once they start to change, they don't feed at all anymore. So they do this, you know, many thousand kilometer journey without eating, essentially. So they're utilizing all the energy reserves. And then when that reproduction happens, they die. And then the young, they're known as leptocephali. The larvae are these clear, transparent, leaf-like critters.
Yeah.
Somehow, and this is the thing that's always fascinated me, find their way all the way back to New Zealand, and only New Zealand. They're endemic to this country. So the longfin eel is only found in New Zealand. just like the New Zealand, so just like the Australian eel, Reinhardi, also only makes its way back to Australia. However, the odd Australian eel has also accidentally found its way into New Zealand. And in fact, you find them in the Waikato River, what we were talking about before,
yeah.
The odd one here and there. But a New Zealand longfin has never been found to have accidentally turned left at Albuquerque and end up in Australia. So somehow they understand, even with climate change and all the currents and everything that are going on, how to get back to New Zealand, and yet they've never actually been here as larvae. So it's almost like something has been passed on maternally,
yeah,
through into the young, so that they know how and where to come. And they supposedly come back in a sort of an anti-clockwise direction in New Zealand. So the West Auckland Current that comes down along our coastline,
yeah,
they come down through there, and then they populate in the sort of anti-clockwise direction, but they'll make it all the way right round the country, because you can find them across.
Do we know if the offspring of the mother come back to the exact waterway?
No, we don't know that. And I think there are probably emerging technologies where we can start to look at things like that.
That's a DNA thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit of a DNA thing. The other interesting thing about that journey too is that no one knows the exact location of where that reproduction takes place in the Torres Strait. They know the general area, and the way in which they've established that is to put satellite tags on a whole bunch of migratory eels that pop off at different times during the migration, and like a cookie crumb trail. Then you try and then you find the area where they kind of aggregate. And on these trackers, these satellite trackers, they also have pressure sensors on them.
Yeah, okay.
And those pressure sensors can tell you how deep the eels are traveling. And temperature sensors as well. And so what the eels are doing is a night and day migration in through depth. So they kind of go down and then they come up, and it's like a cyclical pattern. So not sure if it's to regulate temperature, not sure if it's to avoid predation, or whether it's a more efficient way to actually undertake that journey.
But maybe they're doing it for fun.
Maybe they're doing it for fun.
The whole thing seems like a lark, an unnecessary lark anyway. They've been tourists. Really.
Going on a summer.
That's what it smacks of to me. So how deep do they, the Tonga Trench is deep, right? So how deep can they go?
That's a good question. I'd have to go back and have a look at the depth tracks on that.
You get to the point where the water pressure is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's more than a couple of hundred metres, I know that.
Okay, so it's not the full, the trench is kilometres deep, isn't it?
But I can't actually, that's a good question. I should know the answer to this, but I can't remember that. I should look this up. I'm going to look that up later. I can't remember how deep they actually dive, but they do it in a day-night cyclical pattern, which is really interesting. Funnily enough, sharks do exactly the same pattern when they do big migrations, like the great whites. They've done similar. Yeah. Maybe they're tracking the eels.
The eels are following something else.
So they get there. Then those larvae come all the way back to New Zealand, and then they we actually have. There's three species of eel in New Zealand. There's the short fin eel, which you also find in Australia. There's the long fin eel, which is endemic just to New Zealand. And then there's this Australian eel, which occasionally makes a wrong turn sort of thing. Yeah. So there's those
three.
But
it isn't really established.
No, not really. Like they're definitely there. Like, I've probably only seen three or four in my entire sort of career here sort of thing. But the eel fishermen who commercially fish, they regularly pick one or two up throughout all their nets
An interesting question would be if the adult, you wouldn't do it, but if you took a New Zealand eel, put it in an Australian waterway.
Yeah.
And then it does its migration to breed, and then where do its offspring come back to?
That's a good idea.
That would be a really interesting... I'd love to know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't do that because you wouldn't want to establish the New Zealand population accidentally in Australia.
Yeah.
That's Australia and New Zealand have enough trouble with imported species as it is.
I like that idea. But yeah, that you're right. But it's quite interesting. Actually, when I was doing... a fascinating little story when I was doing my doctoral work down in Otago University, and I was playing with another native fish called the giant cockapoo with radio transmitters, and they have this ability to home back to their same location after floods. So they use floods to explore like river corridors and things.
Oh yeah.
And then as the water recedes, they know how long they've got to get back to where they've come from.
Oh, right.
And so I had little transmitters on these things, and then I had this one fish that was living in this one tributary of this river, and I thought I'd do exactly this, but on a very small scale. I took it away from its place, and I put it upstream of this tributary that was originally living in. And what it actually did is it made a new home, because it was during base flow conditions, because it couldn't actually get back to where it wanted to go to.
Yeah.
But as soon as the first flood came through, it dropped about, I think it was 400 or 500 meters downstream, and immediately turned up that tributary and went back to where it was, you know, months before that I'd actually captured it. So what that illustrated to me was that those fish, you know, a lot of people think, oh, fish have 2-second memories. That's a fallacy, and in fact, it's been proven to be wrong.
Yeah.
They have very good spatial awareness of their environment. And in fact, they're tracking resources, right? And so they know where to go to find food. They utilize conditions, in some cases, to their advantage to go and find things. You know, places inundate, worms come out of the ground, and eels do the same thing, and that's where they get a lot of their energy. Is the flood idea is where so much energy is mobilized for ecosystems in freshwater. Yeah. And that's where, you know, the productivity of the system really cranks. We've tended to stop flooding from happening because we put houses on floodplains.
Yes, yeah, that's been a bit of an issue.
Yeah, that's right. And so this is, again, being aware that those parts of those ecosystem processes, they should be allowed to happen in those areas, and we need to be mindful that, you know, if we're going to put ourselves in that sort of situation, that, you know, it comes with risk, you know, and not only in terms of ecosystem effects, but also in terms of, you know, human sort of, you know, tragedies in some cases, as we've seen. So,
it's interesting. I wonder what the benefit is to the fish that it knows that it has its home.
Well, it's mainly around energy. So if you have an area that you know well, you know, you're a local, you know where to go to get your things. You don't have to compete or fight with other people necessarily to get those same resources in an area that you don't know very well.
Yeah.
And so there's an advantage to that. If you're not doing very well in an area, it might be more likely that you're going to move to try your chances elsewhere where maybe you can actually, you know, make a better fist of it, sort of thing. So yeah, generally it comes down to knowledge and energetics.
Interesting.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So economic migration can happen with fish.
Yeah.
Oh, so yeah, and so, I mean, it always seems kind of cruel, but if you took them to a whole new stream which wasn't connected to their stream.
Yeah.
I guess they'd just have to set up shop somewhere else, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so...
they're not going to go out to sea and come back.
No, well, so, you know, salmon are a classic example. We have salmon in this country. They were introduced, you know, for sports fishing and things. But in the US, the salmon there are really interesting in that they reproduce in fresh water, and they also migrate back from the ocean. But the young are born in fresh water, and then they go to the ocean. But when they're born in fresh water, the signals from that environment in which they're in, the smell of that forest, the organic carbon that's in that particular watershed, it has a unique signature. The chemistry of that watershed has a unique signature. That is imprinted on those young fish, so that when they're at the ocean and then when it rains and they come back as adults to come and reproduce back into fresh water, they can smell the place where they were born.
Right.
And they can track back to the exact same stream. So you can understand that because the young has been exposed to it. But in the case of the longfin eel,
Yeah.
Right? You're over at the DNA. You're in the Taiwan Trench, right? You're born as a larvae. It's like, where do I go now? How do I know to find my way back? I think it's absolutely fascinating. So
there's been this science around DNA has been interesting. It used to be very deterministic.
Mm.
And then they discovered, first of all, that there wasn't enough DNA to do the things that they thought was supposed to be doing. Well, not DNA is the wrong word there. But there's a lot more. It's a lot like DNA is much more of a two-way street these days. I'm using vague generalized terms because I'm trying to remember something I read a while ago. But information can actually be written into the DNA, I think, is where I'm going.
Yep.
And so I guess that's the only way it can happen, isn't it?
Well, you know, you have a lot of things that'll do the same thing, but then you'll have mutations and things that in some cases end up being an advantageous thing. And if it's an advantageous thing for that animal, then that gets retained, and then you kind of, you know, it's sort of like you see this in lots of different examples. We were talking about invasive animals before. You know, when they introduce like a Calciri virus to kill rabbits, right? Or what you'll find is that, yep, it'll kill a hell of a lot of rabbits, but there'll be a certain proportion of them that aren't affected by it. And genetically, they are less predisposed to it. And so they're the ones that end up reproducing. And it's a little bit like antibiotics. You know, like if you use too many antibiotics, like it loses its effect. And then suddenly, you know, in the case of the Calciri virus with rabbits, you end up with a much stronger population that doesn't work for very well anymore, right?
So that becomes, all the rabbits become resistant because that's the only ones that can survive it.
And that's genetic diversity. The majority, you'll get 95%, or you might even get 99%. You only need a small percentage, and that's why it's so difficult to eradicate something or whatever. But the same thing works, you know, with animals in terms of them having benefits to their, you know, nature will select for those things, and genetic diversity is a good thing because it enables those things to persist.
Well, yeah, it enables life to survive, basically.
That's right, but we're changing things at such a rapid pace that genetics generally it takes a bit longer for those things to kind of manifest. So if we're changing things very, very rapidly, it's going to be really interesting to see how the genetics of animals kind of adapts to that rate of change, I guess.
Hey folks, we've been talking to Bruno David. It's the end of the show for the day and for the week. It's Friday, isn't it? I'll see you all again on Monday morning.